so excited to be introducing Helen Moore, or reintroducing Helen Moore to the NAVA Club. She is here frequently. Her home group is the TOCO group that meets on Wednesday evenings at 8 o'clock. And she's living proof that this program really works. And she's got a track record with sponsees that second to none. And she is going to share her story tonight. So please welcome Helen.
I'm an alcoholic named Helen Moore. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink in 44 years. I'm impressed by that. I didn't intend to not drink for so many years, but it just happened that way one day at a time. I was born. I mean, you can tell I was born sometime, a long time ago. I was born in Texas and grew up in New Mexico. And tomorrow I'm going to have lunch with a friend from Macon, who's a retired Georgia Tech instructor. And he and I have known each other for 76 years. And still in touch. And it's wonderful to see these people every once in a while. It reminds me how old I am, but that's okay. It beats the other part if you're pushing up grass. I wouldn't be here. Well, anyway, I had a good childhood, a wonderful childhood. A good psychiatrist told me that, and and I argued with him. I said my perception of my childhood was not all that great. But he said, I knew that my parents loved me, and I said one night here, or one day here, that when I took my first four step, when I was around AA, I wasn't in AA, you might say, when I took my fourth step, I wrote my fourth step, and it sounded like Cinderella gone bad. And that's about right. I wasn't honest in the least. Anyway, I graduated from high school and went to college in Lubbock, Texas. And I'm from Carlsbad, New Mexico. And came home, went to work at the potash mines, and I was pretty, I was smart, and I had a good personality, and I had a lot of friends, and I had a good life. I started drinking before I was 21. You're supposed to be 21 in New Mexico. It may be different now, I don't know. I had my first drink at 15. I don't remember it. It was not important, but I have a picture of me. I was sitting on the fender of a car, and we wore blue jeans in those days. We haven't come very far as fashion is concerned. And I had on a pair of blue jeans and a plaid shirt. And I had a beer in one hand and a big cigar in the other. And that was you could tell my attitude. Anyway, I didn't really have a problem. I didn't get into trouble with a capital T for a while. We all drank. and we all had fun. And I got married once, and I was drunk. I didn't know that I was drunk until I went to a high school reunion, and they told me I was drunk that night, and pretty drunk. I know I'd had something to drink, but I didn't realize I was drunk. And we divorced 4 months later. He wanted a family. He wanted a home and a marriage and a family, and I wanted to party. So I divorced him. But one of my shortcomings or character defects showed up at this time. He called me one night. I was at my parents' house. I moved back with my parents. He called me and he asked me to go to his father had had a heart attack, and he wanted me to go to his father's hospital room with him, and I wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't do it. And that was the first time I remember being that selfish and that self-centered. Then I went on and partied and married a couple of years later. And we were married for 45 years when we divorced. I'm sure that Howard wished that he'd only been around 4 months when when I got rid of him too. But we stayed together for, you might say, for the sake of the children, or for, I don't know why we stayed together. He liked other women and liked to chase them, and I disapproved, and a little bit. Anyway, I moved back up here by myself. We were living in Florida, and I moved up here by myself, and one night one of my sponsee said, is your husband in Al-Anon? And I said, no, he's in Florida. And, anyway, we were transferred to California, and my life changed at that time. I became really, in one day almost, I became an alcoholic. When we moved to California, it was like, if you liked to drink, it was like going to heaven. Where we lived in New Mexico, the only place you got liquor or wine was at the liquor stores. And a lady didn't go by herself, so I took my children. In California, you could buy wine at the grocery store, the shoe store, any place you went, you could buy wine. And one afternoon, I drank a little bottle of wine about this high, and we lived in an apartment hotel, and I put the bottle in a paper sack and broke it up and took it to the incinerator and lied about it. Howard asked what had happened to that little bottle of wine, and I said I didn't know. And I blossomed. I became, I'm just right there, you know, lying and hiding it and everything. And the day that we moved, anyway, one time in California, I came to, I was bad to blackout. I don't suppose any of y'all ever had that problem. But I was real bad to blackout. And I came to, and I was going 80 miles an hour on a freeway, and I didn't know where the hell we were. And my kids were scared to death. They were in the back seat. And it got bad. It got bad right then and there. When I was 29... I turned 29 out in California, and the day I was 29, on my 29th birthday, I got drunk on wine. I'm an ex-winette, and I thought, here you are, one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel at 29 years old. You're getting old and everything's going to pot. Your children are growing up and they don't need you. They were 3 and 5. I didn't even have the third one yet. I was a crazy drunk, you know. I don't suppose any of you ever were, but I was crazy, and I call myself Helen Old Girl. And I said, Helen, old girl, this is the end of the road. Well, it was just the beginning of the end. I went 6 more years and got into more trouble, and I drank, and my kids were frightened at times, and my husband didn't know what to do. When they made the 12-step call on me, he said it was the first time ever he had ever had a chance to talk to someone. Celia, the lady who called on me with her husband Sam, she was an Al-Anon, and he could talk to an Al-Anon. He said he used to drive away in the mornings to go to work, and he wondered who he could possibly talk to about the hell that it was at our house. And they kept my secret. I was a hidden housewife drunk, and I had a thing that I did, and I had bleached hair, and they put a dark rinse on it to keep it from being brassy looking, and that black rinse got all over my collars and my pillows and my drunk chair. And I'd get drunk, and I'd drink 2 or 3 bottles of wine, and I'd be drunk, and I'd think, I gotta get clean. And I thought, I'll take a bath. And then I remembered I had read or heard someplace that this woman was drunk and she fell in the bathtub, poked her eye out on the faucet, and died. And I thought, I could kill myself, you know. So I said, Helen, old girl, will shower. And I thought, that's just as dangerous, you know. So I washed my hair. And I rolled it up in these pink curlers, and one curler would go this way and one would go that way, you know. And I wore this old pink robe that I never washed. It had cigarette burns in it, cigarette holes, and it was a mess. And I put that on every time I got drunk. I think I wanted to look as bad on the outside as I felt on the inside. But anyway, Howard would come home and he'd say, you've been drinking. And I thought, how does he know? And we fought a lot. I would drink a bottle of wine down about until where there was about this much left. And then I'd water it, and kind of fill it up and leave it where he could find it. And he'd pour it out. And I always picture him. I still remember him standing at the kitchen sink pouring out my liquor. And with this look on his face, you know, this I'm doing something good for her, pouring out her liquor. You know, it was just making me spend more. But anyway, we went on. In 1961, we had, in the meantime, we had lived in Idaho, California, Louisiana, Idaho, and we were back in Texas. And a hurricane came up in the Gulf, Hurricane Carla, 1961. And it frightened me. I didn't know much about hurricanes because when you live in the desert, you don't worry about hurricanes. And we left. The children and I left, and I had a psychic experience. My neighbor, her husband was in the Coast Guard, and she knew a lot about hurricanes. They had lived in a lot of hurricanes, and she was telling me about hurricanes and what to do. And she told me to save papers, important papers and stuff, and I did. And everybody thought I was crazy. But the next time another hurricane blew up, they asked me what they should do and save, because I was lucky enough to have saved a lot of stuff. But anyway, we went to Dallas, and we had a station wagon, and I had it packed in the back, and the kids were up front with me and the two children, and I was pregnant. And we were I don't know where we were, but someplace in Texas, and I got stopped by a cop, and he was a young cop, and he was all spit and polish, you know. He'd evidently just come on duty, and he was all starched and perfect and everything, and he stuck his arm on the window like this, and he was asking me questions, and the kids started crying, and they said, "Oh, Mommy, is he going to put you in jail? What are we going to do?" And they got hysterical, and he thought, "Oh dear." But anyway, we had Big Black Lab Joe, and Joe crawled across all the suitcases and everything and came up to the door, up to the window, and slobbered all over his arm there. He finally just said, "Oh, go on, lady." And Howard went back to our house on Wednesday, I think, and we were destroyed. Nothing was saved in the house. Anyway, I went and got the dog and the cat out of the vets, and we were staying with a friend, and right across the street from the vets was a liquor store, and I went and got some vodka and some beer. And I went back to the house where we were staying, and it was 105 degrees. Mm-hmm. And I was pregnant. And I locked myself out of the house, and I sat in the backyard, and I drank the vodka. It was a pint, I think, and four or five beers. And when my husband called that night to tell me that everything in the house was gone, we'd been destroyed, I didn't know who he was. I was in a blackout. And I did remember some of the things he said. He called me early the next morning and asked me if I remembered. And I said yes. And so he said, told me to take the kids back to Carlsbad, put them in school. We'd just wait a while and see how things shook out. So I got in the car, and all through West Texas, it's dry mostly. The counties are dry. And finally I saw a sign that said beer at a little restaurant. And I pulled over, and my middle daughter said, "Where are you going, Mommy?" And I said, "I'm going to go get a beer." I think I was on the verge of DTs. I was shaking and just, you know, just going to pieces, really. And she said, "Oh, please, Mommy, don't. Please." And my oldest daughter said, "It's okay. Two beers won't make her drunk." Anyway, I got those two beers and settled down. Later on, after I was in the program, a doctor told me, when in doubt, give them a drink. And when you make 12-step calls. And so I knew what to do for myself. I gave myself a drink. And I made it to my brother's house in Hobbs, New Mexico. And he had a bottle. And for the next 3 weeks, I hardly drew a sober breath. I embarrassed myself. I embarrassed my family. I embarrassed my friends. And I was pitiful, pathetic. There's some sad sights in this world, and one of them is a drunk pregnant woman. And that was me. We made it back to Texas City, and we fixed our house. Well, our house got fixed up, and we settled down. We moved to outside Texas City to a little town called Hitchcock. And that fall, this was later on that year, and one day, the middle daughter, Terry, I have to tell you about my daughters. They all have the little pouty lips that shake, and you know, when they cry and the tears roll down the side of their face, and it just breaks your heart. And she stood up in the she didn't want to go to school on Monday, and she said, "Mommy, I don't want to go to school. I don't feel good." Well, I took her to the doctor, and he couldn't find anything wrong with her. So he said, "Just take her home, and if something shows up, we'll do something about it." So on Friday, she came, and she had finally gotten the courage to tell me. She said, "Mommy, I can't go to school because I'm afraid." So I called the doctor and told him, and he said, "Helen, I know a senior resident, psychiatry resident at the Texas University of Texas Medical School over at Galveston, and I want y'all to go see him." And so we went over there, everybody but the dog and the baby. In the meantime, I'd had a baby. And my daughter sat there, and she cried, the little lip quivering and the tears going down the side of her face. And she said, "I'm afraid to go to school because I'm afraid the house might catch fire and my mother wouldn't save my baby sister. I'm afraid that someone might come in and hurt my mother and my baby sister. And my mother couldn't do anything about it." And she went on like that, told her story, and broke my heart. But I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't quit drinking. But anyway, the psychiatrist had a father in AA, and he'd been sober 17 years. So he knew exactly what I was. There I was, just, you know, naked before him. And he sort of gave up on me. I mean, he didn't bother too much with me. And he got Howard alone and filled him full of Al-Anon propaganda. And things changed at our house. Everybody became a tattletale. Whereas before they'd all hidden me and not told anybody that their mother was a drunk, they suddenly were telling everybody, and you know, groceryman and everybody. And I still didn't quit drinking. But in the psychiatrist had told me about AA, and in February of 1962, or 63, whatever, I stayed drunk for 4 days. Howard had he was chief engineer at a refinery, and they had a turnaround, and he was gone for 4 days, and I was drunk for 4 days until Sunday night, and he came home, and I came out of my blackout, and he said, "Helen, I need a wife, and the children need a mother, and you're not fulfilling either capacity." He said, "I want you to pack your little bag and go." And I knew he meant it. Now, as an alcoholic, we all have that little antenna that tells whether or not they really mean what they're saying. And this was the first time I knew he really meant what he was saying. But I was in pretty bad shape. I'd been drinking wine for 4 days and hardly eating. The next day, he went to work, and he came home at lunch. And I had gone to the grocery store, and I was having a bridge party on the Tuesday after this Monday. And I had gotten some wine and some beer. And Howard came in, and he said, "What have you had to drink?" And I said, "I've had 4 beers. Will you call AA for me?" And he did. And I heard his end of the conversation. It always hurt my feelings. I heard him say, "She's drunk, of course." And then he said, "What do you want me to do, feed her coffee?" And Sam on the other end had said, "No, all you've got on your hands then is a wide awake drunk." And so they came out. Sam and Tia came out and made the 12-step call. And there I was in my pink robe, my hair curled in the curlers and everything. And they, anyway, they had told Sam, "It doesn't do any good to feed her coffee. Take her outside and walk her around." So Howard had me put on my raincoat, which was almost as bad as my robe, and put a kerchief around my head. And we got out the door, and I said, "Howard, people are going to see me." And he said, "It's about time someone besides me saw you." And as we walked around the neighborhood, he said, "You could see the Venetian blinds opening up like this." And anyway, they came out. And Celia said, "Has she got anything to drink?" And Howard said, "Yeah, she had a couple of bottles of wine hidden in the washing machine." And, I mean, it was dangerous to turn on a switch in our house without checking first. And he said, "But I poured it out." And she said, "Doesn't do a bit of good." She said, "An alcoholic wants a drink, they'll crawl 3 miles to get it." And I perked up and I thought, where did she hide her wings under that little raincoat? And because she was the first person that had ever mentioned my feelings, that I'd do anything for a drink. I used to think of committing suicide, and I always wanted to do it some way where the kids and Howard wouldn't be ashamed. And I thought about getting in the car and going 80 miles an hour and hitting a concrete abutment. Then I thought, no, it'd be my luck. I'd just be in a body cast from here on down and couldn't go get a drink. I needed it. So I forgot that. And so they talked about meetings and so forth, and they took me to a meeting the next night, and they had fed me orange juice and brewer's yeast and something else, forgotten now. But anyway, I sloshed. I walked. I was so full of that orange juice and stuff. But the next night I went to a meeting, and the first meeting I went to, the guy in Texas, you mentioned your sobriety date. If you don't, they'll wait for you. And they just sit there and look at you and wait for you to tell how long you've been sober. Anyway, he'd been sober 22 years, and I thought, yeah, nobody can be sober 22 years. And so he said he used to drive around South Texas in an old Model T, and if he ran over someone, that was their problem. He was always in a blackout, and everybody laughed. And I thought, oh dear, what's a nice lady like me doing in a place like this? But anyway, I went to meetings, and I stayed away from a drink. Now, I never got into the program, but I stayed away from a drink, and things got better at our house. And until the next February, and 2 weeks to the day before my first birthday, I drank. And I called Howard and told him, and it was a real sad thing. They gave you a card, a yellow card, and they put stars for your years. And they had filled out a yellow card with my name and my sponsor's names and everything. And they tore up the card, and they erased my name off of the blackboard for my birthday. And I felt like a member of the French Foreign Legion in an old B movie, you know, where they get drummed out of the Corps. The guy goes up to him and does him one epaulette and slaps him across the face, and another epaulette and slaps him across the face, and he goes out to the desert to die. And so the next time I drank, I didn't tell him. It was, yeah, you laugh, but I almost died. On New Year's Eve, December the 31st, 1964, it was a real pretty day, and Howard was at work, and the kids were out playing, and he had gotten about 20 bottles of liquor for Christmas because he was chief engineer. And I opened up a bottle, and I fixed a drink, and I drank it. I fixed another drink, and I drank it. And I fixed another drink, and I took a sip. And I thought, Helen, old girl, what in the hell are you doing? And I stuck the cork in the bottle and hit it. And didn't drink all of that, and poured it out. Now, I had never poured out liquor before, but I poured out the rest of that drink. Anyway, I didn't tell Howard when he came home, and he accused me of drinking. And I said, oh no, and I went real dramatic, you know, about how good I'd been and not taking a drink and everything. So I nearly died. I lost weight. I started shaking. I was about to die. I was so miserable because of that lie. Later on in the year, we met Sam and Celia. They were my sponsors on the street, and they were going to a retreat at Brownwood. And they said, we want you to go with us. And Howard said, I can't. We're having another turnaround, but I think that Helen ought to go. So he didn't know what was the matter with me, and I really was in bad shape. So I went. But first of all, another hurricane came up in the Gulf, and it headed straight toward us again. And I prayed mightily for it not to hit us so I could go to the retreat. And it hit New Orleans instead, and I felt real guilty about it. When I took my fifth step, the minister said, Helen, you don't control hurricanes or anything. You don't control anything but yourself. So anyway, I went to the retreat. And on Saturday night, Dot Mooney from Statesboro talked, and she told about one day when she dressed her sons, when Dr. John was in Lexington, dressed her sons and sent them to Sunday school, and she wanted to go, but she couldn't. She was so sick, she had to stay home and drink the beer in the icebox. And I thought, I know how she felt. That was me. I had done that. I had seen people go by my house smiling and carrying their kids to school or going back to the post office or something. And she wanted, I was like her, I wanted to do something clean and honest, and I couldn't. I had to stay home and drink the wine. So the next day, the guy who talked was a preacher's sort. He did his hands like this, you know. He was saying, "You're the only honest people left in this world." I thought, "Who, me?" And I got sick. I thought, if I sit here 1 minute more, I'll vomit. And so I got up and walked out the door, and Sam caught me, and he said, "What's the matter, Helen?" And I said, "I have something to tell Celia. Send her down to the lake." So down at the lake, I told Celia what had happened about the drink, and she laughed like all sponsors do, you know. She laughed, and she said, "Well, we knew something was wrong with you. We just didn't know what." So it took us 6 hours to get home, and we talked about the program. We talked about the big book. We talked the program. And got home, and Howard came out to the car to get the suitcase, and I walked up to the house, and my oldest daughter said, "Mom, what happened to you? You look different." And Howard turned me around by my shoulder and said, "You do look different." And I said, "I'll tell you later." So the next morning, before the kids got up, I cornered him in the hall and I said, "You know, Howard, remember New Year's Eve?" Well, of course he didn't remember New Year's Eve. And I said, "I lied about taking a drink that day." And he looked at me and he said, "Helen, if that's the only lie you told this year, that's a great." That's real good. And so the next week I did a lot of things. I told my group what I'd done. I did a fourth step and a fifth step. And the first fourth step I ever took was with our little minister at the church, little church where we were, a young man. And I didn't want to make him think badly of me. And I wrote out my fourth step, and it sounded like Cinderella gone bad. And this time I was honest. And anyway, that was the beginning of my recovery. The next month, we were transferred to Atlanta. And it's been it was a whole different world, a whole different scene for me. Everything was different. I was happy. I was happy, joyous, and free. And I began to live a life in AA that brings me up to now. As most of you know, I do a lot of sponsoring. And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to watch women grow. It's like watching a flower unfold. You know, there's the bud tied. It's tied at first, and then to watch them as they come along in their recovery, and they start blossoming, and they look different. And it's wonderful. I have one of the pamphlets that we have is my favorite. It's the Members' Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have one with me tonight, but I've read it so much that I know at the end he tells it's a speech made at the American Psychology Society by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who was a psychologist. And he tells about his story about being in AA and about AA. And at the end, he says, at AA, he's always reminded of the Bible story where John the Baptist is in prison, and two of his disciples go and ask him if he's the one or if Jesus is the one. And he said, "Go and observe and come back and tell me." And they come back and say, "The blind see, the lame walk. And the good news is preached to everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen, for the good news. That was great. Seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, donations tonight support our group and AA its own. And I've asked Roy to give out the chips.
Thank you. I'm Roy. I'm an alcoholic. And here we have a chip system, as in many other groups throughout the country and the world. First of all, we have a white chip, which is the international symbol of surrender. That moment when God makes that change in you, when you can go out and accept a different way of life. Anybody want to join our way of life? Starting off fresh. Are coming back. And after 30 days and 30 nights, or thereabouts, we have a silver chip. And I look at that, and it's got a Serenity Prayer on it. Think before you drink. The time to call your sponsor is before, not after. And I look at that, and I say, well, that's made out of aluminum. Now, I come from St. Louis, Missouri, home of Budweiser, which is something very delicious for me. And they recycle over 100% of the beer cans that they put out. And I look at that chip, it's made out of aluminum. I must be responsible for at least a million of these. Anybody have 30 days? Okay. And after 90 days, we have a red chip. They say that's the red going out of your eyes, and you can see it there in the chip. Life's starting to get a little bit better. Anybody have 90 days? And after 6 months, one half a year, we have a yellow chip, golden sunshine. Think of that. Your life is getting so much better. And you think about, boy, half a year ago has already passed. Anybody have 6 months? And after 9 months, we have a green chip. And I was told that that's the color of the grass growing back between your house and the liquor store. Anybody have 9 months? And then, last but not least, is not the last, but the beginning of 365 days. Last year, you had to work an extra day because it was leap year. But we have a blue chip for years or multiples thereof. Anybody? Yay! Who are you?
I'm Jim, an alcoholic.
Yay.
17.
Yay.
August 8th was actually my anniversary date, but I'm picking up chips at every meeting that I go to regular, and I haven't picked up one here, so just letting you know. Still trudging.
Yay, congratulations. Thank you. Do we have anybody else? Another blue chip? Years or multiples thereof. Congratulations on the chips you have.
Thank you, Roy. If anybody changes their mind, we will keep a white chip up here for you. Anybody here with a key to the literature cabinet? Okay, great. So you can see these guys. Any other announcements? AA announcements before we close the meeting? Yes, sir.
I'm carrying on that holiday. The registration forms are after the Atlanta's workshop. It's all AA related. We've been going on for over 20 years, and there are scholarships available, and I can link you up so you can see the afternoon.
Great. There's a dance the 31st. Saturday night? 9:30 is a DJ. And it's $3 for singles, $5 for whatever. Just come. We'll lend you the money. any others? Okay. Next Monday, Russ M. of the Cobb County Fellowship. He'll be telling his story. And he's been sober since 91. And then on Labor Day, we've got Peter R. He's active the 5:45 Monday through Friday here, How It Works group, and has had a long string with the 1:30 group, I believe. And he's just has a new job and some new responsibilities, so he's become more active in the How It Works group. Any other announcements? Okay. Well, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever remind us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Hey, let's go.
Who always makes an AA meeting special?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power and glory forever and ever. Amen.
Yeah, I got time.